What do you want to do tonight?
The same thing we do every night, Pinky. Try to take over the world.
Yeah, Metaball Football's on the air!
Kalaka Puyo wins it like a titan! He's brilliant, the captain! Rises like a colossus! Above and hammers this one down with his beautiful curly head!
So if you're looking for the latest on the greatest sport in the world, as well as some hot opinion, interviews, entertainment, all that other good stuff, you come to the right place. Mad About Football.
Listen to my puppy show and don't miss a part. No eating, no drinking, and no peeing their pants.
Is this what you want?
Hey everybody, what's up? This is Juan from Mad About Football. What's going on? Glad to have you all back. And we're here. Wait, do we have a busy night? We've got a huge night tonight. We alongside the usual cast of characters, we got El Negrini. We have George Metellus alongside El Pividor and Mike Lopez. We also have a guy that's an oldie but a goodie. We also have Mr. Kevin Walker. What's up, Mr. Kevin Walker? And the MLS guru himself, Kartik Krishnayer. But most importantly, we have a very special guest. We have CNNSI and Goal.com writer Luis Bueno. Luis, how's it going, man? How you doing?
Hey, doing pretty good, man. Good to be with you guys.
Hey, likewise. But first of all, Luis, I'm sorry, you're going to have to bear with us one second because earlier this week, we had somebody commit a fatal sin, a fatal, fatal sin this week. And with us, we have Sexual Chocolate himself, George Metellus, Father George Metellus, trying to exorcise those demons away from this particular individual. Father George.
I want everybody on the show today. I want all y'all to bow your heads and pray as I bring the word of God down.
Oh, amen. Amen. Oh, please, God. Please, please get these demons away from Cardi. Please. Please.
Can I get an amen?
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Hallelujah, brother. Hallelujah. Give it to me.
Oh, amen. Please. Please get these devils, these devils of the premiership away from Kardec, please.
Devils of song. Devils of
foul spirit, come on out.
Kelsey Blue.
Oh yes, please get away that blue Satan away from us. Blue Satan of Chelsea, please. Kardec.
The Red Devils of Manchester United. Good Lord. Oh my goodness.
I wish the Devils had gone down.
Cardi, dude, what were you thinking when you said that Barcelona have no chance against Chelsea? You're coming on here. We're gonna have to castigate you, man.
Yeah,
I really don't believe Barcelona.
Luis, I'm sorry. Luis is like, what the hell is going on here, Luis? Man, I was talking to Cardi earlier in the week, and he was saying that Barcelona had no chance against Chelsea in the Champions League semifinals.
You can say Barcelona has no chance against, I mean, Barcelona got a chance against any team in the world right now, and that's going to be a great matchup right there, but I don't know about no chance. I think Cardiff might have gone off on the deep end on that one.
I think Chelsea's the favorite, but I will revise my comment. I'm not going to say they have no chance. I do think, however, we'll get to this later, I'm sure, on the show, Arsenal will beat Manchester United.
Yeah, you got a shot there, man. You got a shot there, yeah, as far as getting that one right. But come on, I mean, Chelsea has no... I mean, come on, they were letting the goals.
They've got the best manager in the world right now in hitting. Now they have him on rent. You know, he's not going to be there next year.
But you know what? Last time I checked in the stats, he hadn't scored a goal yet.
Yeah, and I guess he's conceded plenty. The way you're looking for them.
That wasn't his fault. That's Peter Cech's fault. He hasn't conceded any goals yet.
And that's also the fact that I think their back four are really shaky. But I just don't like the Barca's back four. I love Barca's attack. And Xavi right now, maybe the best player in the world. Iniesta, obviously. And Lionel Messi for me is at the top. And maybe we get into this Messi-Ronaldo comparison. I'd love to get into it because the other outlandish statement that people think I made this week was that Messi is much better than Ronaldo. And I will stand by that. I don't think that it's even close, personally.
I like the way you talk, trying like a true man right there. I like that. But first of all, I wanted to get off, didn't want to get off subject too much. But pretty much one of the big topics that we wanted to talk about, and since we have Luis on here, was the two big derbies going on this week. Actually, three big derbies if you include Inter-Juventus. But Mike, you have the floor as far as this is concerned. Explain to these guys why Boca River is the best rivalry around.
There's people that actually have heart attacks with this game, like literally. Like, it's just way too intense, way too passionate. It's something. It's one of those. Wasn't it on that list of the 100 things that you got to do before you die? Is actually go to one of these rivalry games. You know, if you're in that list, you know, it's pretty heated. It's something that it's really an experience. Not really about if you're going for Boca for River, but if you're really the soccer addict, it's something that you definitely have to witness. Now, obviously, now you know who I'm going to be going for, but it's quite the matchup, man. They could be dead last in the league, and it'll sell out. Half the country will be paralyzed just to watch this game on Sunday afternoon. It's pretty crazy.
You know what? Mike mentioned about people, you have to see it. That's how you know it's a rivalry, when it becomes like a tourist attraction. Then you know, like, it's an event. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I mean, that's the case. I mean, they were selling tickets for $500, and not only that, you had like tourist attractions, and I think there was one, and this is just, you know, me talking to my brother-in-law, that and George might like this one. A strip club had an offer, you know, going to the game, getting a tour site, and going to the strip club after the game, you know, that kind of thing. It's all these little packages. And I'm sorry, what?
With the stripper? Like, you go to the game with the stripper?
I don't know about that. That's beyond me. You know, I've never been to one of those things before, so I would never know. I don't even know what a strip club is, to be honest with you, so I wouldn't be able to tell you. You know what I'm saying?
All right. But
you sound like a river.
You know, growing there, bro.
But let's get to the nitty gritty things. I mean, there's been a lot of
talk. Why do I not believe that?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, dude. And I was a virgin before marriage, man. But it's all good. Anyway, let's not even get into that subject because. But anyway, there's been a lot of issues going on with this match in the past couple of days. A lot of people, question marks, injuries. Like Riquelme hasn't practiced in a couple of days. Falcao is still a question mark. Up to tonight, right now that we're recording, he's still a question mark. Is Fabiani going to be in? I mean, they brought in River has one of their under 19 players to come in and possibly even start at the point all by himself. Mike, let me get your opinion. I mean, what is it about this edition of the Super Clásico right now that's making it so intense and so different compared to other ones?
Well, I don't think it's any more intense than any other one. I think it's just about as intense as every other derby or Super Clásico match. Maybe except for the exception of in 2004 when they met in the semifinals of Libertadores, that's pretty intense. But as far as a league derby, I think it's just as intense as any one. The special, I guess, variables going into this one is, do you have Riquelme on the pitch on Sunday? And if you do, how much was injury on his bottom part of his foot going to affect him? Bataglia's not going to may not play either. He's got a
ankle injury. Yeah.
Ankle from what I read. Right. Fabiani, the big mouth, hasn't been. He's been practicing, but he may be on the bench. Falcao is questionable, like Juan said. So there's, you know, it's kind of, you know, what kind of derby we're going to have? You know, is it going to be a battle in the midfield? Is it going to be more of a of an open game? We'll both go out and speculate. You know, I think both. Well, I think River has a lot more to lose, given that they're a lot closer
to the top
of Argentina. Right. Yeah, they're only like 4 points away. Boca right now is 11 points away, and you know the league kind of took a back seat, obviously, to the Libertadores now, which is their main priority. But so I don't know. I think it's gonna be quite the match.
Now, I wanted to switch shift a little bit, well, and ask an individual like Luis Bueno, who sees a Super Clásico like that, like Boca River, you know, from the outside looking in. What's your take on this, Luis?
Well, it's interesting. Like, you know, I mean, Argentina, pretty much, you know, anybody who runs Argentina, who they support, and I think 95% of the time you get either Boca or River, you know, and it's just so ingrained. I ran into some lady once, and she'd been living here for like 2 decades, and I asked her where she was from, to Argentina, and immediately I said, Boca River, and right away she's like, "Ay, River," you know, like I was offended that I would even ask, you know. And so this is somebody that is far removed from Argentina, but, you know, it still has the passion, you know, and that's the one thing that, you know, the football lovers you can respect is, you know, the passion and you know, the rivalry that exists. You know, I mean, Boca River is, I mean, top five, you know, to anybody in the world. I don't know how you could deny that, you know, even if you're in Europe and all you want follows European football, you know. I mean, just look at one. All you gotta do is just go on YouTube and search the supporters' chants, you know, during these games, and you get a feel like, wow, this is just amazing, you know. And then you had all the history, and you know, the stadium, the Bombonera and Monumental, and it's like, you know, it's definitely on my thing to do, you know, to watch one of these games in person. You know, I never have.
Have you? And obviously, another rival that's going on is Chivas America. Have you been to one of those types of games? I mean, whether it be at Chivas America, you know, obviously you said you weren't at Boca River, but have you been to any of those types of derby games while covering or anything like that?
The only Chivas America match I've been to was they played a friendly here in L.A. in 2005, and they did have a doubleheader with Chivas USA and the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. I was at the Coliseum, and when they first announced it, you know, because it was during the season already, the season had started in Mexico when the game was played. And I originally thought, oh, okay, well, that'll be, you know, some good turnout, maybe 50,000, 60,000. It was like 89,000 there to watch it. And this was a friendly game. You know, it was week three or week four of the season, and, you know, nothing was on the line, and you know, only 90,000 people there on a Wednesday night, you know, to watch this game. And I was just amazed, you know, and just the turnout, and I think America won. They still had Blanco, he came in the second half, and it was just amazing, you know, to be there, even though it was just a friendly, you know, to feel that passion. And, you know, I've always made it a point to try and go down to you know, attend one of those matches. When there's something online down in Mexico, you know, Sunday's game would be, you know, it's like any other, you know, like you guys are saying about Boca River, you know, this game is always, you know, one to watch. You circle the calendar when it comes out, and you know, it doesn't matter how the teams look when they're coming in, you know, it's a great game.
Speaking of coming in, where do you see both teams coming in?
Well, obviously right now, Chivas is going through a bit of turmoil, you know, in Mexican football, it's kind of like a team loses two or three in a row and all of a sudden the coach is on the hot seat. You know, I think there's been, I think at least seven managers that have been fired already this season. The season started in January, and Chivas has gone through two managers. They're on their third manager, and his first match will be Clásico, and his first match ever, you know, will be a Clásico. It's Francisco Ramirez, the assistant coach from Mexico, who slapped Frankie Hayduk. You know, he got the job with Chivas, and
he was Sven's assistant, correct?
Yeah, he was Sven's assistant. He was also the assistant under Ricardo La Volpe for his whole tenure. So, I mean, he's been around the game, you know, as obviously World Cup and, you know, things like that as an assistant. But is definitely, you know, and he was also an assistant under Enrique Mesa. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, he's been around the game, but, you know, now he's got all sorts of pressure on him. And, you know, just the fact of taking over a club like Chivas, you know, but then you throw in that his first match is going to be a Clásico, and you wonder, you know, how focused the team will be, you know.
I see. Now, what's the status with Salvador Cabañas as far as him? Is he still going to play? I mean, I know he was questionable the past couple of days, so I don't know exactly what's his status.
They're leaning towards not playing him because, you know, Chucho Ramirez, America's manager, mm-hmm. just doesn't want to risk him. You know, and America, they have a good shot of making the playoffs, even if they lose on Sunday. And, you know, the last thing you want to do is risk a player like him, and then, you know, he gets hurt, and then now you lose him the rest of the way. And so I would be surprised if he starts, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see him in the second half, if the game is even or if America is losing.
Now, Luis, I mean, the status of America as well, is this season so far, their precedent of not being able to win at home, not being able to win at home, and not being able to really establish themselves at the Azteca. How big is that in the psyche of the players right now, knowing that a team like Chivas can come in and grab a point, obviously, or maybe even grab the 3 points. I mean, how big is that in both the team psychology as well as, you know, with the presses and the Mexican press, particularly in Mexico City? How big is that right now? How big a factor?
Well, you know, that's something that they've kind of used as a motivating factor, especially when they go on the road. You know, they tend to play better. And I don't know if it's because they expect to play, you know, better, and so they do, or, you know, they're just in a different environment, and they're not worried about, you know, having to break their duck at home, and so they're able to play more relaxed. Certainly at some point, if they want to do anything in the playoffs, they're going to have to win a home game, you know, and it sounds kind of ridiculous, you know, America can't win in the Azteca, but that's the situation it's in right now, and the media certainly, you know, made a big deal about it. Mm-hmm. And that's something, if the players let it affect them, it can affect them, and I think it is affecting them, to be honest, because they played Indios on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I think Indios had scored 2 goals or more twice, you know, in 13 games. And they scored 2 goals in the first, I think, half hour of the match, and they ended up tying 3-3. And, you know, when you have a team like Indios to score 3 on you, and they honestly could have had, you know, a lot more. They had plenty of chances. They hit the post a couple of times, you know. So it's definitely affecting their play, you know. And I think it's important for them to get that win before they go into the playoffs, because if they finish the regular season without a home victory, you know, then you have the pressure of Liguilla, you know, with America, there's always pressure to win. So you're just going to magnify it. And this team isn't, and they have, you know, Pablo Pardo, Cabañas, they have a couple of veteran players, but they do have a lot of youth, and they have a first-year manager. So you get the pressure, you know, and that might be enough to, you know, sink this team before it really even they give themselves a chance.
What will be your report card so far with, what will be your report card with Chucho Ramirez right now?
I think, you know, like I said, it's so crazy with the managers, and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm always kind of lenient towards the manager and mm-hmm. give him a chance, you know. And you look at Puma, Tuca Ferretti was in the hot seat this season because I think they lost like 4 out of 5 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And now they have the third best record and the third most points. You know, they're one of the favorites definitely coming in, you know. But, I mean, he was on the hot seat. So I think with Chucho, I think he's doing, you know, pretty good considering he's his first ever club position. Mm-hmm. You know, he seems like he's got the right demeanor. You know, he's not a fiery guy. He's not somebody that's going to get in players' faces. You know, and he knows how to develop youth and work with youth, and that's what America need. You know, they need to start, you know, getting their youth and producing it, you know, and having those guys come in and really take control of the team. You know, so I know, you know, there's criticisms of him where people say, well, you know, the America need a big manager, but, you know, I think let Chucho grow in the position. I think he could be like somebody like Enrique Mesa that, you know, can stay with the club for, a while and, you know, bring championships and things like that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Luis about Enrique Mesa because Pachuca, once again, they've just been fantastic. I watched the game last weekend against Toluca, and that was a real heavyweight match. And Mesa makes a tactical change at halftime. He brings in Caballero, who's obviously he's been there for years, and he still gets the job done. They score three goals in the second half, and they win. They're atop the table now. Obviously, both teams are going to be in the playoffs, but. Why is it that Mesa was, after he was fired by the FMF, the first go-around with Mexico, and he's been so successful with other clubs before he got to Pachuca, why hasn't he been given another look to be the Mexico manager?
I think he admitted that he wasn't ready for the international game and, you know, everything that goes with it, you know, and not having the players around that often and, you know, having to focus on short-term results and, you know, long-term, you know, building players. And he admitted that, and he was in over his head, you know, and once, you know, that he was, I actually met him back when he was with Atlas, and it was after his stint with the national team. And, you know, he was saying he was really grateful that he had the chance and that, you know, he didn't realize that all the work and everything goes into it. And yeah, I think because he did so poorly and he admitted that he did so poorly that I don't think he's been mentioned again, because I honestly don't think he would want any part of it. You know, I don't, he's obviously not a young manager. He wasn't young when he had the job. So I don't think it's something where, you know, that he's grown now and he's a different person. You know, I think he's just not international material, you know, and he's obviously very successful in the league, and, you know, he's successful with Toluca, and he's obviously successful now with Pachuca, but the national game is just not for him. You know, he just failed, and he failed pretty bad at it. You know, and his player selection was questionable. You know, his teams weren't playing attractive soccer at all. So, yeah, I don't think that's the road they want to go down again.
I mean,
it's funny because I think. I think Pachuca has won more international titles in the last 5 years under Enrique Mesa than any club in the world. They won more international tournaments than any club, Manchester United, Boca, anyone. So that's I think his record speaks for itself. But Luis, thanks for that, because I've just not understood why they haven't taken another look at him.
Luis, but
here...
yeah, he's
go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, Mesa, you know, he was the first Mexican coach to win a South American tournament with Pachuca when they won Sudamericana, you know, in 2006. So, yeah, as an outsider, you easily think, okay, here's just the most successful coach internationally. It's not just about winning national titles, you know, success abroad, CONCACAF and all that. But, yeah, I don't think it's something that, you know, he ever wants to do again.
Now, Luis, I mean, now going back to that whole national team manager thing, just the format, the way that, you know, it's not like you have one person that you answer to. You have 20 other individuals that you have to answer to who have little power struggles going on within each other. You have a monthly report card, for all intents and purposes, that's what it is, those monthly meetings that, you know, Hugo Sanchez and... you know, Sven had, and Ricardo La Volpe had before that, and on and on and on. Do you believe, or are you a proponent of there being some kind of change in that aspect as far as how the national team coach should be supervised or not?
You know, it just seems strange, you know, like you said, you have 20 people to answer to, and you get factions, and, you know, you get politics plays a big role, and in the managerial spot. So I think it takes a certain kind of person to succeed in there, like a La Volpe and, you know, Aguirre, guys who are going to do their own thing and, you know, they're not really going to care about what people say because, you know, they're confident in their own ability. But that's not the most ideal situation because there's only, you know, obviously you look down the list and success, you know, hasn't been there for a lot of managers. So I think ideally there would be a change, you know, and there wouldn't be as many people with, you know, varying opinions, you know, running things, and everybody's got their own opinion. Everybody thinks they're right. You know, I mean, these aren't just 20, you know, it's not just a board of directors. I mean, these are, you know, businessmen, multimillionaires, you know, and they each have made their fortunes, you know, inside football or outside, like, you know, Jorge Vergara, and, you know, they're very opinionated. So they're used to running companies their own way. And you get 20 people like that. I mean, it's no wonder why this is such instability. You know, it's no wonder why they make knee-jerk reactions, you know. And like I said, you get factions, you know. Right now you got Néstor de la Torre, you know, he's took over for Guillermo Cantu. Mm-hmm. So he's probably like the third in charge.
Yeah.
You know, you have the president, and Andesio de Maria is the secretary, and then Néstor.
Yeah.
And so his family with Eduardo de la Torre, who's in charge of Cruz Azul, mm-hmm. and his Jose Manuel de la Torre, who's manager of Toluca. So it's natural to assume, okay, at some point, you know, Chepo de la Torre is going to be the manager of Mexico, you know, because this is just always politics, you know, and you could look at it from now and say, okay, after a year, they're going to bring in Chepo, you know. Not that he necessarily doesn't deserve it, because he's won two championships.
Yeah.
You know, but, I mean, you know, certainly nepotism plays a role in that.
Yeah, and it's, and like you said, it's not the it's not having 20 people. It's having 20 people like Jorge Vergara, having people like the Azcárragas, you know, with Televisa, having, you know, I mean, 20, I mean, one of the things that I talked to George and Mike, you know, whenever we start talking about Mexico a little bit, is one of the teams that's most notorious to really fry their coaches is Tigres. They've had 20, I think almost 25 coaches in the span of, you know, 20 years or something like that.
Jesus.
So, I mean, when you have guys that are trigger happy, you know, they're ready to make the move at a heartbeat. I mean, that really must put an additional pressure to any coach, obviously.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, it's, like I said, you lose two or three games, and all of a sudden, no, there's a crisis, and, you know, the manager's going to get fired, and, mm-hmm. and, you know, with the national team, I mean, you lose a couple of qualifiers, and all of a sudden, you know, it's magnified. It's like, wow, you can't go through any sort of bad stretch, and, you know, it's that mentality, and I just been trying to think, maybe it's the short season that's really doing them in, because, you know, you have a longer season and there's a couple of games, it's not that big a deal, but in the short season, you know, the playoffs start to get away from you, and mm-hmm. and that's when people overreact, you know, and they need to go back to the one, you know, like everybody else, you know, most everybody else, even Europe, anyway, you know, the long calendar, and, you know, then maybe the owners will change their mentality. But certainly there has to be some sort of change, you know, with the owners and how they conduct their business.
Mm-hmm. Well, one more question on my end.
I had a real quick question for Luis. You know, the controversy about foreign players playing in Mexico, or for the national team, I should say. What's your take on that? What's your take on the whole, should they not be? What's your take mostly on the backlash toward naturalized players? What do you feel about that whole situation?
But, you know, I think that's kind of like outdated thinking, you know, to not allow, you know, foreign-born players play. I mean, you know, you can make an argument and say, well, you know, there shouldn't be mercenaries or whatever, but you got a guy like Cigna who came in pretty much just like any other player, and, you know, he improved and he made himself a player in Mexico. You know, he came up through the second division and he plied his trade for a long time, and he toiled, and, you know, he just so happened along the way to get his passport and became a citizen. You know, so you look at a guy like him, and why wouldn't you consider him for the national team simply because he's not born in Mexico, you know? And I think some of the outrage just was over, like, Guillermo Franco, and, you know, he'd only been there a few years, and he's got his passport, and then, you know, they kind of fast-tracked into the national team. Well, maybe you can make a case and say, well, you know, that's not kind of playing by the rules, but even still, you know, if the Constitution says they're Mexican, then they should be able to play, you know, and I think that's just kind of, you know, I don't know why people make an issue of it, and it kind of seems like sometimes the media fans the Flames a little bit, you know, and because, you know, Aguirre, for all he did, you know, all the good he did, he was the one who kind of started this with Gabriel Caballero when he brought him into the national team, you know, and now he's back, and that's one of the first things they asked him, you know. That's one of the first things that Hugo Sanchez was asked, you know, and so you hope that it's not, it doesn't become an issue, and you hope that whether Matias Bozzo stays on the team or not is because he fits on the system, not because, you know, where he was born. But yeah, I just think people just need to get over that.
Yeah, I wondered about that because of the comments, you know, Guillermo Ochoa would make regarding
Fingers
that.
Are.
I was wondering if that was, you know, one of the reasons, if there was some type of dissension within the locker room. I mean, I'd read an article in El Universal in Mexico, I believe that's the name of the publication. And they were saying that there were, you know, that Sven's days were, you know, this was right before Sven was going to get sacked, that whoever was going to get his job had to deal with something greater than the national team. I mean, he had to deal with trying to unify three different cliques, the veterans, the young players, and the naturalized players. So, I mean, is there any substance to it? I hope there isn't, but is there any substance to what they're saying about that?
Well, there have been cliques in the past when Blanco was his day. Mm-hmm. He didn't get along with, and he doesn't get along with Borghetti. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of the guys that came up with Atlas, you know, Borghetti and Marquez, Pardo, Aldo Sanchez. You know, those guys, they're kind of, you know, cliquish back in the day. So, yeah, it seems like now with Ochoa, you know, starting off, you know, obviously that doesn't go in line with, you know, everybody, but that sentiment is still there. So, you know, you have guys that were loyal to La Volpe, you know, you have guys that, most, and, you know, it's a lot of the guys that he brought in, you know, he brought in Carlos Salcido, Omar Bravo, you know, he brought in Guardado. There's a lot behind the scenes, you know, that the manager will have to, you know, Aguirre will have to take care of, you know, and Ochoa, I mean, I think he just kind of like, I don't think he thinks through what he says because he can say some very outlandish things, you know, and whether he honestly feels like that or he's just playing up to, you know, his fans and, I mean, he's a popular guy, you know, but it's just, you know, you would think that it's the older guy who would have a problem with it. No, because it wasn't really acceptable 10 years ago, you know. But now, you know, a guy like Ochoa is what, in his early 20s. You know, I mean, as in when he came on the scene, they were, you know, they already went through that issue with Caballero and some of those other guys. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would hope it's isolated to just a couple of knuckleheads like him.
Yeah, for real.
Luis, where do you, I mean, your personal opinion, right now in the qualifiers, where do you see Mexico ending up in? Do you see them as the Mexican media, you know, as hysterical as they get? Do you see them actually ending up in fourth place? Do you see them being, you know, safe? You know, I'm talking about top three. Or do you see them actually, there's a possibility of them not making it? I'm of the school that they're going to make it regardless.
Well, I think, you know, they have had a first really tough stretch. You know, they had games in U.S., which didn't, you know, obviously they don't do well here. And in Honduras, you know, and they don't do well there either. So they got their two toughest road games, well, two of their three toughest road games out of the way. And, you know, they came out with losses, just like they did in 2001. They lost in the U.S. and they lost in Honduras. I think the most important thing for them is they can't drop points at home. They have to win out, you know. So I don't know that they're going to lose at home. If they do, it would be the U.S. game, simply because I think the U.S. is, I think this is, you know, the year that they could do it, you know. I think maybe Bradley's going to bring in a different type of thinking and mindset when they go play down there. But I don't know. If they went out at home, I think it'd be very difficult for Mexico to miss the World Cup. And I would say that about any team in CONCACAF. You know, if you get max points at home and you tie a couple of games on the road, you're in. That's the formula for success. You know, that will do it every time. And so I don't really see Mexico dropping any points at home. Whether that translates into fourth place, you know, because they still have to play in Costa Rica. That's not going to be easy. El Salvador, I mean, you know, they haven't lost at home. That's going to be Aguirre's first game. You know, El Salvador's obviously been together for a while. It's going to be tough for them, to be honest, to win, I think, away from home. But I think, for me, the worst-case scenario would be that fourth place. You know, I don't think that they're going to completely miss it, but I do think that there's a chance that they could finish in fourth.
I actually think... I just want to say I don't think Costa Rica is dropping any points at home. Saprissa is the toughest place to play in this part of the world, and they're going to get 15 points at home. So that puts a little more pressure on Mexico and Honduras and the United States, quite frankly. The United States could drop points at home very easily to Honduras or Costa Rica.
That's true. I wanted to ask Luis real quick, what are you hearing about Mexico and a possible hosting of either the 2018 or 2022 World Cup? Because the last two times Mexico held the World Cup, they've been, you know, some of the best World Cups. You know, I mean, in 70, I think 1970 was Pelé's last World Cup, and then in 86, you know, Maradona, that was Maradona's World Cup. So what are you hearing about Mexico and the preparations or the possibility of them getting one of those two events?
Well, I think it comes down to if FIFA wants it in this part of the world, you know, then it comes down to whether Mexico or the U.S. gets it, you know. And I think it'll be tough for Mexico to beat out the U.S., you know. I think, like you mentioned, Mexico is close to two of the best World Cups ever, you know. They kind of got a bit lucky, and the two greatest players, you know, of all time were kind of hitting their peak, you know, when they visited Mexico. But I think that the fact that they were, I believe, the first country to host two World Cups, you know, they hosted them in such a short amount of time. I think that kind of plays against them, because the U.S. could argue that, you know, they've only had it once, and, you know, the sport has grown tremendously because of the 94 World Cup, and, you know, it could still grow, you know, if we host another World Cup here. The facilities, I mean, you know, to be honest, a lot of the stadiums in Mexico are a bit outdated. You know, in the U.S., we don't have that problem here, obviously. Yeah. So I think it just comes down to, you know, to that, you know, and can they beat the U.S., you know, in the presentation for the World Cup to FIFA. And I don't know if they can. I mean, they have a tradition. Obviously, the Estadio Azteca is the only venue to host two World Cup finals. You know, they got great cities all across the nation, but, you know, I mean, like Sunil Gulati, if you've ever heard him talk about the U.S. and their their capabilities of hosting a World Cup, and the man is very convincing, you know, in his spiel, and I just don't know that they can compete with that.
It's pretty hard to also compete with a letter from Barack Obama as well, asking to let him host the tournament as well. But so Luis, I mean, tell me a little bit about yourself, man. I mean, how did you get started in this whole business, in this whole, you know, rigmarole of writing about soccer?
Well, I always attribute my ability to, you know, cover the game to my being bilingual, you know, speaking Spanish. You know, I started a local newspaper out here in San Bernardino. And I liked soccer, and I was, I think, the only staffer in the sports department to speak Spanish. So, you know, naturally, my editor was like, oh, we'll have you cover the Galaxy. It was in 98. You know, Mexico played down here. So they just kind of sent the, you know, oh, let's send the Mexican guy out there, you know. And that's just kind of how it started. you know, because 98 is still, you know, not the dark days of soccer, but, you know, you had the Gold Cup that wasn't on TV. You had Libertadores, there was like on closed circuit, you know, it wasn't anything that was popular, but the pop, it was growing, you know, so the demand for coverage was there, you know, obviously with MLS and you had the Galaxy, it was successful, so, you know, and obviously the internet wasn't a big deal, so I was in the paper and, you know, they wanted coverage, so I was able to go out, you know, and I think if I would have been, you know, the same for like a major sport, and say, you know, Dodgers or whatever, I wouldn't have been able to get in the door that quickly. But, you know, because I was bilingual and I liked the game, I think I got a bit of a head start, you know. And so that kind of grew. And I've just been freelancing ever since 2001. I was lucky enough to cover the Under-17 World Championship down in Trinidad and Tobago in 2001. And I went to the World Cup in 2002. So, you know, I did some pretty exciting things, you know, early in my career, but yeah, it's just, you know, and also being a freelancer and living out here in Southern California, where there's so many games, and I think there's 50 to 75 games a year, you know, and I mean, just look at July, we got Chelsea versus Inter, we got Milan.
You know what? Don't tell the guys down in Miami because they'll start crying.
Yeah, man.
We do have Javier Aguirre living here, though, which is the good news.
Well, there you go. You got the next national team manager in your backyard.
Yep.
Yeah, and they have Canada playing over at FIU Stadium for the Gold
Cup. Right. We do get Costa Rica, though. Oh, we do get Costa Rica.
Okay.
We do get one.
Okay. You at least be getting a lot of ladies, you know, going to the games. That's for sure.
It's the only good thing. That's the only good thing, yeah, for real.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask Luis real quick about Chivas. You were saying LA Galaxy, because you mentioned, you know, being Mexican and everything. And I got the impression that from the minute that Chivas USA was created, it seemed like, and maybe this is going to sound strange, but it seemed like the gringos were LA Galaxy and the Hispanics were Chivas USA. Am I right or wrong in that? Has it broken down into that way where the gringos, the quote unquote gringos, are LA Galaxy fans and then the Hispanics are Chivas USA fans?
I think in the beginning, I think that's what the ownership for Chivas kind of anticipated. And I think, you know, that's what they thought would happen, but it didn't happen. There were a lot of, you know, Hispanic Galaxy supporters, Mexican, Central American, and there still are a lot of, you know, Hispanic Galaxy supporters. I think the last home game, the last Galaxy game I went to, there was a guy wearing a Beckham jersey holding a Mexican flag, you know. So, I mean, obviously that tactic didn't work from Chivas USA. And I think they realized that after the first year that it wasn't going to be that easy on the field with, you know, the kind of team they were trying to build, and it wasn't happening off the field either, you know. I think one misnomer, though, about the makeup of Chivas USA fans is people think that they're just Chivas Guadalajara fans. But I wore a Cruz Azul shirt to a game recently, and I was walking down through the fans, and this guy wearing a Chivas USA jersey said, "Hey, I love your shirt, man. That's my favorite team in Mexico." You know, so you got all sorts of different fans that, you know, support Chivas USA. It's not just, you know, Chivas Guadalajara fans, which I think, you know, to be honest, I think that's what the club had expected too when they came into the league, that they were just going to have a lot of Guadalajara supporters.
Because it seemed like when that first came up, that was kind of the impression that I got. But I'm glad that the lines are, you know, now it's just I like this team for whatever reason, so that's cool. All right.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you got all sorts of different types of players, you know, and it's been like that for a while for Chivas USA. You know, obviously there's not that many Mexican players on the team. Livingston and Mariano Trujillo, Carlos Suarez, you know, he hasn't played, but those are the ones on the squad right now. You know, so yeah, you look at the stands, and there are a lot of Hispanic fans, you know, a lot of Mexicans at Chivas USA games, but, you know, there's other fans too of other ethnicities, and you get that too with the Galaxy. You know, you get a lot of mixed, you know, cultures. It's hasn't broken down into the, you know, like they said at first, the Latinos versus the Gringos or whatever.
I mean, you brought up Claudio Suarez. How old is he? Like 143?
Jesus.
Yeah.
That's or at least insane. Seems like it. Or at least seems like it, yeah.
Luis, speaking of an older player, and we mentioned him earlier, Jared Borghetti, any thought that Javier Aguirre may call him back into the squad, especially if Vuoso is pushed aside because of the naturalization issue?
I think if Borghetti was getting regular minutes, I think that he would have more of a case. But he's not playing, and it'd be really hard to justify bringing him back into the squad. Even though he did well, under Aguirre, and how he scored a couple of really great goals. You know, that goal against Italy in the World Cup was a great goal. But he has too much mileage on him, and, you know, he's not playing. That's just the bottom line. You know, if he was playing and not scoring, then, you know, he might be in the conversation. But, unless something happens with this club situation, I don't think he's going to get a call.
Luis, how do you see the Mexican clubs faring out in Libertadores?
Chivas, their instability, obviously, is a minus. San Luis, I think they need a little bit of a miracle to get in. I think they need to win, and then they need some help. And to be honest, if they get through the first round, I think they'll just be so excited, you know, they won't do much. I think Guadalajara, they have to make a run, they have depth, you know, they have players who've been there before. Obviously, they were semifinalists two consecutive years, and it is a tournament that they want to win, you know, but, you know, with a coach who's never coached a club match before, you know, asking him not only to come in and take the team into the playoffs, but then also to have success in South America. And I think that's asking a lot. So I think that they'll get through to the next round because I think they just need a draw against, I believe, Everton to get through. They're atop the lead to the group right now, but, you know, I don't know. I think a lot's going to depend on who they get in the knockout rounds, you know. But can they make it to the quarters? Yeah, I think they can make it to the quarterfinals. Semifinals, I think, might be asking too much, though.
Perfect. So, yeah, Luis, man, look, man, we really appreciate having you on. It was great to have you on. Anything else? I mean, is there anything you'd like to promote? Anything that, you know, you'd like to let us know that you're, you know, any features that you're planning on doing over at CNNSI or at Goal.com?
Just check me out at goal.com. You know, I just started there, took over the Mexico section right before the U.S.-Mexico game, and, you know, just trying to build up the coverage there. And it's been hard to get in the past some consistent, coverage of Mexican football in English. You know, you get the odd AP story every now and then, but, you know, to get something that's consistent, you know, I mean, we're the only ones right now on goal.com that provide that stuff. So definitely check us out there. And I actually got the chance to interview Jose Mourinho out here, and the story came out last week on SI.com, but if you haven't seen it, you know, for sure check it out. And that was definitely an experience. You know, that's probably, to be honest, that's probably the highlight of my career was, you know, the 25 minutes I got to spend with Jose Mourinho.
How was it having special time with the special one?
it was very strange, you know. I mean, aside from just having somebody, you know, who's a prominent figure, you know, sitting next to you, you know, in a room where it's just you and him and like two other people, you know, but to have it be him, to have it be Jose, you know, he's like one of the most recognizable people in the world, and he's such a powerful person. You know, it just seemed weird. It seemed like I seem so insignificant compared to him, you know, like he's talking about the club, you know, he's talking about, I just asked him his opinion on Man U, you know, and he said, oh, you know, they're one of the biggest clubs in the world. And he brought up, you know, this is Arsenal and he said Liverpool, Chelsea, Man U, Inter, Juventus, Milan, Barcelona, Real Madrid. He said, those are the world, you know, the world's most powerful clubs, and that's what he wants to manage. You know, that's the kind of clubs he wants to manage. So I'm thinking, man, here's a guy who can probably, you know, take over one of those clubs and probably lead him to success, you know. And here he is sitting right next to me. He has my undivided attention. Yeah, it's very strange.
I think the FMF would complain if he wanted to be the Mexico head coach. You think there would be, what controversy you think would happen there?
If they were somehow to have someone like him, they'd probably find a way to mess it up, to be honest.
Luis, your blog also, The Touchline, is quite good on coverage of Mexican football and also MLS, and I'm there often, as a matter of fact, checking it out.
Thanks. Yeah. I try to, you know, when I have time to put on there, it's the -touchline.blogspot.com. So definitely check me out there. And, you know, the Press Enterprise is on PE.com. I wrote a weekly column with them. So, yeah, I'm all over the web.
Now, Luis, what do you find the hardest thing to do as far as trying to spread the word about Mexican ball, you know, on the English side of things?
I think the most difficult thing is for people to separate the national team from the league. You know, you can follow the league without being a fan of the national team. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the EPL is very popular here, but is everybody who follows the EPL, you know, root for England? I mean, probably not. You know, so the Mexican league is so intriguing. There's so many storylines, and if people just think that the Mexican league is the next national team, you know, they're just completely off base, you know, and yeah. It's a really exciting league, you know, so definitely would recommend people to watch it.
Perfect. Well, at least with that, hey, man, like I said, thank you very much for being on. God, we went a long time. Hey, whenever, you know, you feel like, you know, want to come in and talk about some, you know, Mexican ball or, you know, any other ball around the world, man, you're more than welcome to drop by, you know, and give us a shout. So you're officially one of us, because you're trying to do what we're trying to do as far as spreading the word, you know, of the game around here, you know.
You got to get his prediction on the Clásico.
Oh yeah, we can't bail, you know, we can't let you bail out without that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you got Chivas.
I would say. Well, I'm probably not going to sound that like I'm taking a big risk here, but I'm actually thinking it's a draw, just because America plays so well on the road, and Chivas is going through too much turmoil right now. I think we're going to see a tie, probably 1-1.
I can't see it any other way. I can't see it any other. Actually, I was even more closer to the belt. I was going to say scoreless.
Yeah, it could be.
You had a little bit more offense going on than I did.
It depends on Cabanas. If he plays, I think America's going to win.
Yeah, if he can go more than a half hour, then definitely I think they have a chance. You know, if he starts, then I think they're going to have a handful, because they're not going to send out Cabanas if he's not 100%. So. If he starts, he's 100%
deadly. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. One more question, and I promise this is the last question. How is the Mexican media looking at the CONCACAF Champions League? I mean, what perspective are they looking at it the same way as the MLS, or a little bit not as nonchalant as the MLS? What is their perspective?
It seems like they're not that interested in it. They're certainly more interested in Libertadores and Sudamericana. Mm-hmm. I mean, those tournaments, they give respect to them. You know, they cover and everything. But I think with they call it the CONCA Champions. I think with the CONCA Champions, they kind of see it, they kind of respect it, because they know that, you know, it's a chance to go to the Club World Cup. But as far as, you know, any sort of accolades to give, extra accolades for Cruz Azul or Atlanta for having reached this far, or, you know, for, you know, getting on Pumas for not getting past the quarterfinals. You know, I don't think the criticism is there, you know, as it would be, say, in Libertadores, you know, if San Luis doesn't make it, or Pachuca, you know, they didn't qualify.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's more criticism on that end. But they cover it, and, you know, but they don't see it as, you know, certainly as Libertadores versus America.
Is it a case of them seeing the – I was talking to Kardec about this earlier today. It's a case of them seeing the grand prize being less than the runner-up prize? Because, I mean, obviously – to them and to, you know, anybody who's familiar with Latin American ball would take winning a Copa Libertadores or Sudamericana over the CONCA champions any day, even if you still get, because with the Libertadores, even if a Mexican team wins it, they don't represent CONMEBOL in the World Club Championships, but yet they still want that one more. Right. Is that accurate to say or not?
Yeah, I think so. I believe so. I mean, you know, everybody's waiting for a team to win Libertadores, you know, and that would be a great accomplishment, you know, if Chivas does it this year, if San Luis somehow does it this year, or, you know, next year, whoever's in it, you know, that team would go down, you know, in history. I mean, like, you know, we mentioned earlier, Enrique Mesa having won it, you know, and all the success and all the spoil that come with that, you know, I mean, that's still something that hasn't been matched, you know, but you have Cruz Azul, if they win Inter Atlante, you know, I mean, they'll be excited, I guess, for those clubs, you know, but they're not going to see it as anything grand because it's just ultimately a tournament that they're expected to dominate and they have dominated. And, you know, it's kind of like, well, what is this? What is the purpose of this? You know, it's just kind of clogging up the calendar, you know, it's not necessarily, let's show our dominance for the region because we're, you know, I mean, you can argue about the national teams, but you can't really argue what's the best league in CONCACAF, you know, I mean, and so they kind of don't see the whole point in making it such a big tournament, I think.
Can I get one more question in for Luis?
Hurry up, man.
Nate Coxa moves and they're about to get relegated. Atlante moves, and they're winning the CONCACAF Champions League. Why has that move from Mexico City gone better for Atlante?
Mexico City is huge. Obviously, it's one of the most populated cities in the world. But Atlante was not – they didn't draw well. They didn't have a big fan base. They didn't really have any tradition. I think they won one league cup in 93 with La Volpe as manager. But you don't really have a lot of Atlanta fans, supporters. So they moved there, just like Necaxa. Necaxa moved to an area where they didn't have first division football. You know, the club wanted to branch out and try and expand in a new area. I mean, Cancun, obviously now with Atlanta over there, you know, they built it up pretty quickly out of the baseball country. So they had to compete with baseball. And, they've done pretty well, you know, people supported them from the start. They won the league the first year, and you know they've kind of settled in there a lot more than they ever had in Mexico City. You know, with Necaxa, they were Televisa's other teams. You know, Televisa had America, and we also have Necaxa. You know, they were like the redheaded stepchild. You know, and now they're out on their own, and they were able to go into Libertadores, and you know, they're in Aguascalientes. They haven't had the success there. Obviously, they're foot in the second division. I hope that they stay just because they have history. They have more history than Indios. And, you know, I think that ultimately they will beat out Indios and stay in the first division. But I think Mexico City is just a three-team town, to be honest. America, Tomas, they'll have a lot of support there. You know, obviously, America has the support everywhere, but in Mexico City, you know, Pumas is a very popular club. You know, their fans are, I mean, I think Francisco Palencia recently said that they had the best fans in Mexico. And he's played for Chivas, he played for Cruz Azul, he's played for, you know, so he kind of knows what he's talking about. You know, they have a really great fan base, too. So I think it's just too hard to compete with teams like that.
Perfect. Well, Luis, this time I promise you we're going to let you go. Thank you for coming on the show. Like I said, whenever you want to come by, let us know. You're always welcome to drop by, man. Thank you very much for coming, man.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
And we appreciate all the info you dropped on us. We certainly got a lot of knowledge dropped on our way. So thank you very much, man.
Anytime.
Okay, thank you.
del destino, siempre.